Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest for this week's podcast is Dr. Eugenia Chang. Dr. Chang is science in residence at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago and has written many popular math books in recent years, including How to Bake Pie and Beyond Infinity. She says one of her aims is to rid the world of math phobia, and she's been interviewed around the world, including on BBC, NPR, and The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Dr. Chang is also a concert pianist. For all of those who are afraid of math, I think this podcast is for you. She has a really wonderful sense of humor, and we had a good conversation. I will note, too, that this was done in her office, and my equipment is humble, to say the least, and so it's not quite as a good recording as perhaps as some of the others have been, but I think you can hear us both, and I appreciate your listening. All right, so Dr. Eugenia Chang, thank you so much for being on the Failing Boldly podcast. I appreciate your taking time out of your schedule to talk with me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I would imagine that you get this question a lot, but how is it that someone who works in the mathematics field is on the faculty of the Art Institute in Chicago? What's typically your response to those who ask that?
Well, the School of the Art Institute is a liberal arts school, so it has people teaching everything, and it's very enlightened, and so the school is seeking to erase boundaries between art and science, because boundaries are artificial, and they are there because of historical anomalies and bureaucracy, but they don't need to be there, because all we're doing is all discovering and investigating things about the world around us. And so they need mathematicians to teach there, and when the opportunity arose, I jumped at it, because it sounded so much like my dream job, to teach math to serious students, but those who might think that math wasn't for them, because I'm sure, and I was sure, and I think I've been demonstrated that I was right about it, that I really can find ways in which math is for everyone, even and maybe especially those who were put off it in high school.
Yeah. Does it help in this in trying to overcome those boundaries because you also are an artist and that you play the piano? Does that help in that bridge building?
I think that it helps that I don't have particular boundaries around different things in my life.
Right.
And so I'm not, as it were, just a mathematician. I do many things, and I try to see things from different angles all the time. And for me, math isn't a clear-cut subject. Math is a very broad and fluid subject that's to do with making connections between different things. And so that's what I say. I say that math is everywhere. And so to make good on that, I have to really show that math is everywhere and that math does make connections between things. And so it's lovely to have a chance to explore that with art students.
I'm going to use a word from my field. In doing some of the reading about you and listening to interviews, it's almost like you're kind of an evangelist for math.
Yeah.
In that you are trying really hard to help people rethink it, especially if they come into it with negative stereotype or if they did not do well in school. Mm-hmm. And so have you seen that as part of your own in the field that you're in, of trying to help people rethink math?
Definitely. And because I love math so much and I want to share that love, it makes me really sad when I see that people have taken against it for what I think are the wrong reasons. And so if someone doesn't like it, but they've never seen the real it, mm-hmm. then that makes me sad. If people see the real it and still don't like it, then that's okay,
right.
You know? And so it's like if people say that they don't like steak, but they've only had really terrible steak,
right.
or something like that, or they say that they don't like something, but they've only had really synthetic,
right.
Mass-produced versions,
right.
and that's not the real thing, the real thing that's made by hand and created with love by people.
Right.
And so I want to show people what it is really, not because I think everybody can be a mathematician or really do math, but because I think that everyone can appreciate it if they see what it is really, and also that it's relevant to them, that it's not just something that somebody else does. You know, it's thought of as something that we can leave that to the engineers, or the scientists, or
right.
the finance people, something like that, and we'll go and do our other thing, our art or our history or whatever. That we don't need that. And I think that we all could do with thinking more clearly. And for me, math is a way of getting our brains to think more clearly. And as a discipline for thinking, I think that's important to everybody.
do you try, when someone comes to you and says right away, in math, I was awful in math in high school or in middle school, and so, and maybe they're taking a class here at the Art Institute, and if they have the mindset of already, I know I'm not going to do well in this, or if they see themselves as a failure in math, what do you do to try to help them get beyond that?
This is one of the things I love the most about teaching art students, because it's almost the exact opposite of when I was teaching math majors. Because math majors arrive in college thinking they are great at math, they're the best in their school, they're the great genius, and then they arrive and they can't all be the best anymore. And with art students, it's the opposite. Many of them really think they're terrible at math, and they were the worst in their class. And it's the opposite, because they can't all be the worst in the class anymore. And so I encourage them by saying I understand why that happened, because high school math is taught in a very black and white way, with right answers and wrong answers, and if you get the wrong answers, you fail. And real math isn't like that. Real math is about exploration and discovery, and that no matter what you do in my class, it's always, you always discover something, and that really relates to how I think math is at a research level. And unfortunately, we save all the best parts for when we're doing research, and we show all the most boring parts earlier on. I think that's all the wrong way around. And so I'm trying to get around that system by showing all the best parts to everybody.
And I guess you already kind of answered that a little bit. When students come, and if they experience a difficulty at first, or if they maybe don't do well, how do you, as a teacher, how do you help them overcome that failure that they may feel themselves?
I think it's important to tell them that I struggle with math as well, and that that's an important part of becoming cleverer. And there's this thing I always say where if you're really stuck and you feel that your brain is contorting and can't do it, you just can't do it, that is the process of your brain becoming cleverer. And one of my favorite analogies is to lifting weights at the gym or working out, because one of the things that people do when they're training seriously is at the gym is that you do reps to failure. And the idea is that you have to push your muscles to the point of failure in order for them to build themselves, because I can't remember exactly what happens physiologically, but then muscles, the cells break or they tear or something, and then they redevelop stronger. And so going to failure isn't global failure, it's just that you've pushed yourself to the limit in that moment, and then you can grow. And I think that's something that our brain does. Maybe it doesn't have, you know, I'm not a neuroscientist, but I think there may be something to it, that our brain is a moldable thing. It's not fixed. It grows according to how we use it. And that if we push our brain to the point of failure and then we rest and we come back to it, then we become cleverer. So it's not a global failure. It's a crucial part of becoming cleverer. And I say to them, if you never fail at anything, you never know where your limits are. You've never pushed yourself. And so in math especially, if you kind of fail, you have, it's never actually a failure, because you've always discovered something along the way. And this is how research works as well. If your idea doesn't work, you've learned something, because you've learned that that idea doesn't work. That's all progress. And even though positive results can feel better in math, where you prove that something does work, if you find that something doesn't work, that's still an important piece of knowledge for the community to have.
That ties into your book, How to Bake Pie, and I, in reading through it, I also confess, as I started reading it, thinking I was just very mediocre in math in high school. But what there is a lot that I really appreciated about the book, including the chapter when you talk about and explain internal versus external motivation. And I want to read an excerpt from the book and then have you say a little bit more about it. And so throughout a lot of the book, you use baking as a metaphor in talking about math. And so you write, if you set out with a recipe in mind, this is external motivation. If you make something up from the ingredients you have, it's an internal motivation. One of the problems with learning math at school is that almost everything is externally motivated. You're always trying to solve a problem, and worse, it's a problem that somebody else set for you, that you probably have no need to solve apart from your math homework or math exam. So I'm wondering if you could say a little bit, which was kind of an aha moment for me. I'd never thought about math as exploration or discovery. I thought about it as, here's a test, like a recipe, here's external motivation. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about internal motivation, because it sounds like, and what I read about you, it sounds like that's the thing that really you love about math, is that internal and exploring part
yes,
of it.
Yes, and it's something that I love about the world as well, and that I tend to be a lot more internally motivated than anything else. And if I can start by talking about external motivation a bit, the trouble with that is that you can fail, because if you're aiming external motivations where you have some aim that has been set from the outside, and then you can fail to achieve that aim. Whereas if you're internally motivated, you're not trying to do anything in particular.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to explore from the inside some kind of situation, or it's like wandering around a city. Another analogy I use is you can wander around a city, you can try and get to a specific landmark, or you can explore and see what you find. And if you're trying to find a particular landmark, you could fail to find it. But if you just set out to explore, you can't really fail. The only way you can fail is by standing still.
Mm.
And this is another wonderful tale I read somewhere in a motivational essay, which, alas, I can't remember who wrote it or what it was about. But it was teaching children who were from very underprivileged situations. And you know that game where you walk in a direction, someone thinks of an object in the room, and you have to walk in a direction, they say hot or cold.
Mm.
And then just by the directions of hot or cold, you find the object. And the only way to fail at that game is to stand still.
Mm.
Because as long as you move in some direction or other, you will get some information back, and then you can build up your knowledge. And I love that image, because it's kind of the same in math research, that the only way you can fail is by not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
If you do something, you will learn something from it. And so with internal motivation and exploring a city just to see what's there, the only way you can fail is if you stand still and close your eyes. And even if you don't move, you can still look around you with your eyes open. And for me, that's a really important aspect of math. And I try to do lots of projects like that with students, so that I just give them some things to play with and to create, where whatever they do, some mathematics will appear out of it. And the only way that no mathematics will appear if they sit down and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no particular aim. And this can be very confounding to people, because high school math and early parts of math are so aim-oriented. You're supposed to get the answer. And
right.
There's an idea that math is about getting the right answer. And I've done outreach projects with school children where sometimes the parents will say to me, so what's the aim of this? And I'm like, there's no particular aim. We're just going to... I give them some shapes and some tape, and you can stick them together and see what happens. And no matter what happens, maybe you'll build a really perfect geometrical form. Or maybe you'll make a random thing that's a bit like a hat. And both of those things have mathematics in them.
Mm.
So the only way to fail is to just sit there.
Is it hard for some folks who may say, what's the aim of this? And when you try your hardest to explain to them, this is not the way I'm going to go about this, is that hard? I would imagine it's hard for them to grasp, because you mentioned earlier that for most folks, when they took math as a child or in high school, it was externally motivated, and they don't get to the, maybe in your mind, the fun things until later on. And it sounds like you're trying to do it the opposite, or?
Well, I think that it starts like that in kindergarten. It starts well.
Okay.
And many of my art students at the School of the Art Institute tell me that they loved math in kindergarten, first grade, or something. In elementary school, they loved math. And then they all tell me, they all have a kind of point where it fell apart for them. But most people love it at the beginning because they give you blocks and you stick them together and you're exploring the world, because they're trying to give you a feel for numbers with no particular aim. And it's only after that where you're supposed to learn your times tables and how to add numbers up. Before that, it's just getting a feel for the world of numbers. And all of math should be getting a feel for that particular world that you're in. And unfortunately, although it all starts well with the internal motivation, at various points through the curriculum, it changes. And that's where people get lost.
Is that in the general field of mathematics then too, is failure, I think again the stereotype is failure is if I do poorly on a test, and that's bad, stereotypically bad. But for those especially who are doing research in mathematics, is it generally then failure is necessary in order for them to continue to prove a theorem or discover something new that they hadn't thought about before?
Of course, different people approach math research in different ways.
Okay.
And there's one idea of two cultures of mathematics. This is by Professor Tim Gowers, who's a Fields medalist. He said that he identified it as being theory building versus problem solving. And so some mathematicians set out to solve particular problems, and that's externally motivated in a way, even though it's still in pure mathematics. So there are long-standing problems that have existed in mathematics for tens, hundreds of years, and they're trying to solve them, and they can fail, because if they don't solve them, they might discover something interesting along the way if they were trying to build a theory in order to solve it. But then if they are really set on trying to solve that problem, they will feel like they failed. And sometimes mathematicians can also set other kinds of goals, like they want to write this many papers, or they want to get their paper published in this journal, and then it can feel like a failure. And I have tried really hard not to set goals like that, but to set goals of understanding something more. And yeah, you can feel like, and you struggle with it every day, because if you feel like you don't understand something more, especially if you think that you should, I kind of say to myself, wait, I should have been able to do that. And so you have to do a lot of pep talking about the fact that well, it's difficult and it's not a failure, it's just you didn't do that today, and that you could still do it tomorrow. And it's only, again, it's only a failure then if you think you were supposed to get there by a particular time. Apart from that, it's just, well, I'm not at that point yet, and that then you try again tomorrow, and then you try again, and it can be hard to measure how far you've got. It's like, it can be like a journey through a very open space where you look behind you and you can't really tell how far you've come. And so having some kind of markers to remember where how much more you understand now can be really helpful. And one of the ways that can happen is by teaching other people, because you then realize how much you can explain to other people. And then it's a wonderful two-way process. And I love teaching because I love sharing what I know and helping people understand things, and because I think it's really important to share whatever we have, whether it's money or food or love or knowledge and wisdom.
Yeah.
So for me, education is part of that important sharing process. And yeah, it's not just an altruistic thing. I get something out of it as well.
Sure.
And so not only do I learn things from my students, but I also get to see where I've come and see that I can help other people come that way too.
Yeah. Do you mind if I ask how, and I would, again, I imagine there's maybe a broad range of responses to your book, especially I'm curious for folks who are mathematicians. What kind of response did you get? Was it a range from people like, thank you, this is great for people to help understand math better? Are there others who also said, why are you dumbing this down?
Fortunately, I didn't get too much of that. I was really prepared to have people say that. Maybe that they don't say it to me, although plenty of people write and tell me hilarious, absurd things. But the mathematicians in my field, category theory, have been enormously appreciative. And that is really nice. And I think that partly they enjoyed seeing my quirky insights into our own subject, and partly it's something that they can give to their families so that their families can finally understand a bit about what they do, and that they can give to prospective students to show them what it's really like. And it was definitely some kind of gap in the literature, because there are textbooks, but often the textbooks, they give you the technicalities and the formalities and the skills, but not the imagery and the feelings about what we do. And sometimes those parts are really important, especially for people who are just getting into the subject, because without those feelings, you don't know why you're doing any of those things. It's just a bunch of technicality. And then once you're motivated, the motivation is so often the first important part of education. And so the category theorists have been really appreciative, especially because it kind of means that they don't have to do so much of that explaining. There are some more old-fashioned mathematicians who have complained that there weren't enough theorems in it, and that's a shame, because math for the general public shouldn't be about theorems,
right.
It should be about enlightenment. And a couple of people have slightly snidely said, well, there's nothing in this beyond middle school math. And I've decided to take that as a compliment, because I tried to make sure that the book would be intelligible even if you don't know any math beyond middle school math.
Right.
But it builds up to very advanced concepts that really come into graduate work in my subject. And so it's completely false to say there's nothing in it beyond middle school math, but completely true, I hope, to say you don't need to know any math beyond middle school math in order to understand these things.
Yeah.
Because that's the level. I knew that even people who've graduated high school probably forgot the last few years, and probably I couldn't rely on anyone remembering anything except what numbers are in a very basic way.
Yeah.
And so I've decided it's good if people feel like there's nothing in it beyond middle school math, then it's kind of like eating a really huge meal in small, tiny bites.
Right.
Where you don't realize how much you've eaten. Then you look back and you go, whoa, what? I ate all that food. And so with small increments, I hope to get people from middle school math and nothing to these very advanced concepts. And with my students, I always tell them, I point it out so they know. I say, do you realize I didn't study this thing until I was doing a PhD in pure math? And they look kind of astonished and horrified and amazed. They don't believe it.
I would imagine showing some of that vulnerability you mentioned earlier, that in times when you struggle, I would imagine exhibiting that vulnerability is helpful, especially as a teacher, for students who may feel like, okay, she doesn't pretend like she knows it all the time and that she makes mistakes along the way too. Is that it? Would you say that?
I think it's important to remind everyone that struggling is part of it. Mm. And I think sometimes people look at people who are good at math and think that they've never struggled. And so they think that if they struggle, then, oh, math isn't for me because I can't do everything really easily like that other person. And of course, we all develop at different rates. And so some of us just happened to have learned things earlier, so that by the time we got to fourth grade or whatever it was, we already knew all that stuff, so it looked easy. And then when we were in fifth grade, we've already done that, so it looks easy. And so at the point where we first did it, it might not have been easy, but at the point when everyone else is doing it in the curriculum, it looks easy. But then everyone hits a point finally when it becomes difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And for many people who are mathematicians, that isn't until they're an undergraduate or maybe even a graduate student. And so no one else ever gets to see it. But certainly when we're doing research, we spend weeks, months, and years bashing our head against a brick wall, feeling very stupid because we don't feel like we're getting anywhere. And I think that one of the things I try to portray about math often is that it's okay to feel like you can't do it. That doesn't mean you're no good at it.
Mm.
And that being confused isn't a sign that you're bad at math.
Right.
Being confused is a sign that your brain is trying to become bigger and more intelligent. And so being confused is an opportunity for discovery. There are some types of mathematical confusion that I just love because I know I'm on the brink of something happening.
Mm.
It's like optical illusions, where I love optical, just even the simple ones where it's some kind of black and white graphic and you move your head and some dots appear.
Mm-hmm.
Something. I love those because I feel very confused and I love swimming in that confusion and not having it explained to me just yet.
Huh.
Because it's something that's mysterious that I'm about to get into. And that feeling of swimming in the confusion and actually relishing it is something that I try to tell my students about.
Do you also relish in the confusion when it comes to playing the piano and baking? Or is there a part of you that feels slightly different about each of those things that you do and engage in?
Slightly different. I do enjoy the challenge of some baking thing that is difficult to accomplish. So if something's really easy and it's very delicious, that's fine. But if it's a little bit tricky and it has a little element of mystery in it, that's fine. It can go too far. I got really obsessed by mistake with trying to make French macaron, and they're very delicate, and the number of things that can make them go wrong is so huge, and you only have to do something wrong by a tiny bit. And so I got really upset because I thought they were failures each time, and then eventually I persuaded myself that even when they're not, as it were, perfect, they're still really delicious.
Right.
They're still more delicious than the ones I buy. And it's the same with playing the piano, that I can feel myself getting better. Of course, when you put yourself in a performance situation, that's when you can really get a sense of failure, because I feel like if I play some wrong notes in a place, then it's all gone horribly wrong. Then I have to remind myself that you can still communicate something even if you play wrong notes.
Mm.
And that what I'm trying to do is not play all the notes correctly, but what I'm trying to do is communicate a feeling to some people and to bring some light into their life by the joy of this music. And that as long as I don't play all the notes wrong, then that joy will probably still come across.
Yeah.
But it is quite easy to go and go, oh, it was a disaster, I played a huge wrong chord there, and then feel very bad about it. So remembering what the aim was really, and to have an aim that can't really fail, I think is
yeah.
important.
Are you able to do that most of the time after you perform, of having that feeling of, I did place a few wrong notes, but what I communicated, a sense of beauty or joy or whatever,
yeah,
is the key.
Yeah, I hope so. And
okay.
Also, I have learned something over the years where I always feel I did my best in that moment. And because I know that I always try very hard, and that I work hard, and that my heart is in the right place, you can't control all circumstances, but I did my best in that moment under those circumstances, and then I can always feel like I did my best. And maybe the next day I could do better in some sense,
mm-hmm,
with some different circumstances, but in that moment. And I feel that's important for making decisions as well, and it's helped me not regret decisions I made,
mm-hmm,
because even if the outcome isn't the way I wanted it to be, I know I made the best decision I could have done in that moment. And there's actually this amazing piece of wisdom from my little nephew, who is 7, and his mum, my sister, asked him what advice he would give to his little brother when he was about to start kindergarten. And he made this amazing motivational video where he said, basically, that the most important thing is that when things are getting difficult and you don't know what to do, that you don't have to try to do perfect. That as long as you try your best and have fun, then you did perfect.
Mm.
And I just think that's wonderful, because there is so much pressure on people, especially young people, to be perfect, or for people to be perfect parents, or to be perfect this or perfect that. And on the one hand, one thing I say is I don't really believe in perfection.
Mm.
But also I think that perfection is just doing your best all the time.
Mm.
And but then also not resting on your laurels.
Right.
So not being satisfied with that, saying, well, I did my best then, now I'm going to see what I can do next time.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're always reflecting on what you did, but not because you think you should have done better at that moment. I did my best at that moment,
yeah,
and now I'm going to see if I can improve on that for the future.
Have you had that outlook your whole life, or is it something that you've come to?
I've come to it.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I used to be much more... I used to berate myself a lot more, and in a way it was because that's sort of how a lot of education happens, and you do something wrong and someone tells you off, and then you're supposed to do it better. And I don't think that's very productive for a lot of people, and I personally hate being told off. And so as a child I didn't exactly want to be obedient, but I was very well behaved because I was so afraid of being told off. Because I just hated being told off. So it's kind of the wrong motivation, I think, but just fear of being told off. And so I was bored in school a lot, but I didn't play up because I was so afraid of being told off.
Yeah.
And then later on, I discovered that they couldn't really do anything to me because I was their star pupil. And then I started playing up because I knew that they couldn't actually do anything. So then I later realized that berating oneself isn't a great way to go about life. And I was spending a lot of time wishing that other people would be more nice to me. And then I kind of thought, why don't I just be nice to me myself?
Mm.
And I read a wonderful book called Self-Compassion by Kristen Neff, talking about how you can look for that compassion from other people, or you can just give it to yourself, and that you can't rely on other people giving it to you, so you can give it to yourself, and then that's a good starting point.
Yeah.
And that has changed for me in the last few years. And it did come through other kinds of failures, like a lot of relationship failures where I counted it as a failure a lot of the time, and I was trying to figure out how to be nicer to myself about that.
Mm. Well, to close things up, I usually ask folks to tell one failure story from their own lives, and that can be from any part of your life that you've wished to divulge. And so I'm wondering if there's a story that pops into mind of a time when something just didn't go like you thought and how you responded to it.
Well, there was this one... can I say this? Okay, I'll say this. I was trying to have a relationship with someone who just wasn't very interesting. And I was trying really hard, and it wasn't going very well. But in the process of trying really hard, I kept looking for things to do. Because if someone is boring, you have to do things. with someone's interesting, you don't have to do anything. You just sit down and you have a chat, and then suddenly 10 hours have passed. And so one of the things that I found to do was a chocolate making workshop. And the great thing was that that relationship was obviously doomed not to work. So that was the failure. But out of it, I learned how to make chocolate. And that has stayed with me.
Wonderful. That's a great note to end on. Good. Well, Eugenia Cheng, thank you so much for, again, taking time and speaking with me about math and baking and chocolate.
Thank you.
Yep. Well, that is this week's episode. My thanks again to Dr. Cheng for speaking with me. You can learn more about her and her books by going to her website, eugeniacheng.com. Again, I hope you will subscribe to this podcast. My next conversation is with Father James Martin, noted Jesuit priest and author. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.